Encuentros, un podcast de Fundación Telefónica, producido por Cuonda.
Buenos días, buenas tardes o buenas noches. Bienvenido a Encuentros, el podcast del espacio Fundación Telefónica en el que disfrutas de manera íntegra de los eventos que suceden en la Fundación. Hoy hablamos del significado del trabajo en el siglo XXI. En este episodio de Encuentros tratamos la primera de las ediciones del ciclo Tecan Society, que se celebra en el auditorio del espacio Fundación Telefónica gracias a la colaboración con Aspen Institute España. En él contamos con Ryan Avent, editor y redactor de The Economist, quien presenta su ensayo La riqueza de los humanos, el trabajo en el siglo XXI. En su libro, Avent analiza cómo la tecnología está cambiando la forma en que se gestionan los negocios del siglo XXI, una evolución que modifica incluso la productividad y la fuerza del trabajo, y va más allá, buscando respuesta a una pregunta básica, pero realmente complicada tras esta evolución tecnológica: ¿cuál es el significado del trabajo en el siglo XXI? El protagonista de esta edición de Tech and Society es autor de libros como The Gary City, el blog del referencia Free Exchange, y ha publicado en diarios de prestigio mundial como The New York Times o The Washington Post. Después de su presentación en solitario, Ryan Avent mantiene una entretenida e ilustradora charla con Luis Villa, Principal Director Accenture CDM Europe y colaborador del Foro Económico Mundial de Davos.
Encuentros, un podcast de Fundación Telefónica.
Thank you very much for that. That warm welcome. I'm very grateful to Aspen España and to the Fundación Telefónica for having me here, and thanks very much to all of you for coming out to listen. And tonight we're going to take a look at what I think are some pretty big topics, some pretty big questions that we're going to confront over the next year, that I think we're already beginning to confront. And I think the place to start is by recognizing that we have a little bit of a problem. As we look around at what's happening in many different countries, with many different political systems and many different elections, it seems like the way we thought the world worked and would continue to work is maybe not what we thought it was. And that in the future, we may have to confront some issues that we thought we had put behind us. Issues related to basic fairness and economic justice, issues related to peace and prosperity. And we need to have our eyes open to what these challenges are going to bring to us. But then we have to work out what it is that we're facing. What are the difficulties that we're having to confront? And why are they having these effects in our political system? And so I think if you consider the breadth, you consider in how many different places we're starting to see social disruption, we're starting to see the rise of nationalist politics, of anti-immigrant sentiment, I think you have to look at very broad causes, very profound causes. And a good place to start, I think, is by considering what has happened to work. Over the last 10 to 20 years, there have been a number of distressing changes in the way workers have had their status change in the economy, have had benefits to them reduced in the economy. And so if we look at wage rates across different countries, for many different workers, they have been stagnant. If we look at inequality of income and of wealth, it has gone up significantly, in some countries more than others, but in most countries we have seen an increase in inequality. And then the thing that I think is most telling is if you look at the share of income, of national income, of what we produce, that flows to workers in the form of wages and salaries, it has been declining steadily, and the share of national income that goes to people who own land or who own companies, own capital, has been increasing. And this is the case across an incredibly broad variety of countries, and I've chosen just a sample here, but you can see it's the downward slope that we've got in rich countries and poor, in countries that we consider to be relatively egalitarian, as well as countries like America that we think of as being very unequal. It's true in countries that do a lot of manufacturing, as well as countries that mostly rely on services. And this is a really profound change in the status of labor in the economy. And it shows little sign of changing even as economic growth finally picks up in parts of Europe and America. And so what could possibly be behind this change? Well, I think that the way to think about it is in terms of abundance and scarcity. And if you think about how something has a value assigned to it, what you can do with it certainly matters, but how much of it also matters. Economists refer to something called the diamond water paradox. How can it be that something like a diamond, which we could clearly live without if we didn't want one, is super expensive, while something like water that we couldn't go without for a single day is typically quite cheap? And the answer is that, for the most part, water is abundant, not everywhere, whereas diamonds are scarce. It's hard to find them. And the place to begin analyzing what's happened to labor is to think about how it has grown in abundance over the last 10 to 20 years. And that abundance has many different causes. One is the incredible experience of globalization that we've seen over the last 10 to 20 years. Another is growth in productivity among very high-skilled workers. And so you have very small companies that can generate billions and billions of revenue, but which don't employ anything like the big companies did 50 years ago or 100 years ago. And then also we have the specter of automation and technological change. And so I think when we stand back, we do need to look at the role of technology. And in fact, I would argue that we are at the beginning of a digital revolution, in the first few decades of a digital revolution, that is going to prove as profound, as important, and as transformative to society as the Industrial Revolution. But it's also going to create significant challenges for us, in the same way that the Industrial Revolution created significant challenges. Now, one thing to note is that we are only in the early stages, and the technologies that we have right now that are disrupting work and affecting work are things like the internet, personal computing, and things of that nature. And what we're going to see over the next 10 to 20 years is the much greater application of things like machine intelligence, artificial intelligence, which has capabilities far beyond what you can do right now with your telephone. 10 years ago, people working in these fields thought that it would be 20, 30, 40 years before we could have cars that could drive themselves through city streets. That seemed like a task that was far too complicated for a machine to handle. They thought it would be 30 or 40 years before we could have machines that could understand human speech and even carry on a conversation with humans, or defeat a human in a game that relied on strategy, like and on understanding emotions, like poker. But now we have computers that can beat humans in the game of poker, can bluff them and show human-like responses. And we have computers that can understand human speech and can, in some cases, do instant translation at a very high level. And so there's good reason to think that the sorts of pressures we've seen on workers over the last 10 to 20 years are going to increase, and that we're going to see many jobs displaced, and we're going to see the workers who are displaced from those jobs not fall out of the labor force necessarily, but compete with all the other workers in emerging markets and place downward pressure on what they're able to earn and lose out where economic growth is concerned. And you can ask yourself this question, but given what we've experienced over the last 10 to 20 years, if we were to see another 10 to 20 years of similar economic struggles for most workers, I think you can possibly imagine what effect that might have on political systems and on a frustration with elites and on the kinds of policies that might be on offer then in that case. Now, luckily we have past experience to guide us, both in what the nature of the problem might be like and in what we can expect from it and perhaps what we can do about it. Many people who work in technology seem to think that technological problems are going to solve themselves, that we can expect new jobs to appear that will replace the old ones, and that perhaps we need not worry so much. And so one important lesson from the Industrial Revolution is that these transitions tend not to be so smooth, that for the first century or so of the Industrial Revolution, incomes for most workers didn't increase by very much. The people who did get the new jobs that were created often lived in very unpleasant conditions, while many of the things that they needed, like food and housing, were too expensive for them to afford. And even after pay started to grow for the workers working in the factories, laboring in the factories, inequality remained a serious problem, to the extent that we had bold new dangerous new, in some cases, ideas about how society needed to change to make the economy more fair. And so I think that is one of the lessons that we should take away, that problems will not solve themselves, and that we should expect people to come up with new ideas, good and bad, to solve these problems. And that process, I think, is already underway. A second lesson that I think we can take away is that there are methods to reduce the difficulties posed by it, such as education, such as moving people from places that are not very productive to places where the new jobs are being created. But then we have to have a word of caution, because in the Industrial Revolution, we were able to take a population that couldn't read and couldn't write and teach them these basic skills, give them basic technical competency and teach them about science and things of that nature, and increase the skill level of the population in a really dramatic way. Now we're in a situation where almost 90% of people in the rich world already have some sort of secondary school degree, where 40 to 50% of people in the rich world go to university. And so it's unthinkable just about to have the same kind of increase in educational attainment now that we did back in the Industrial Revolution. If we were to try to make it so 40 or 50% of the population had a PhD in computer engineering, it would either be the case that we failed, or that a PhD in computer engineering simply ceased to mean what it does now. And so we need to understand that when education can't be relied upon to do all the heavy lifting in terms of solving problems of inequality, other methods will have to be used. And those methods will tend to be political in nature. Now, one important question is, who's going to be the winner as technology places more pressure on workers in the future? And just as abundance can help explain why some groups of workers are not doing very well, we have to look to the factors that are scarce to understand who gains as technology and automation become more of a feature of the economy. So what is scarce in society today? Well, one thing that is scarce is control over the ideas that make the technological revolution possible. And so as we look to the American economy, for instance, we see technology companies like Facebook and Google and Apple and Amazon, companies which have enjoyed extremely high rates of profit for quite a long period of time, companies which are able to use their economic power to buy up potential rivals and to influence legislators in Washington. And so control of these ideas ends up granting to these companies and the people who control these companies much more power than they would otherwise have. Another place where we see scarcity is in the cities, where a lot of the ideas behind the technological revolution are being created and being deployed. So if we look to London or San Francisco or New York, these are places where the understanding behind the digital revolution is being built, where people are discovering how to use these things and how to turn a profit from these things. And yet, many people aren't able to afford to live in these places because rents are too high. And I think as we look at these dynamics, we see something that's fundamental about this digital revolution, which is that in the past, to make a lot of money, you had to own physical things. You had to own giant machines, blast furnaces or railroads. You had to own huge factories and things of that nature. And it was a very capital-intensive revolution. But today, it's not the big machines that confer wealth on someone. It's not Amazon's server farms that give it power. It's its control over ideas, over knowledge, and over data. And similarly, within cities, it's not that there's anything special about a square mile of land in New York City. The thing that gives it value is the fact that the people who live and work on that square mile of land are surrounded by people who are also generating knowledge and using this useful knowledge. But useful knowledge and the ability to do things with the new technologies we have and the data that makes these algorithms run are all what I would consider to be sources of social wealth. They are things that you and I contribute to. When we click on a link on Google, we are providing information to Google. When we use any service that helps train an algorithm to provide us with better services, we're making it easier for these companies to profit. And the fundamental technologies that underlie the web, that underlie machine intelligence and computer science, are all rooted in science and technical advance that has been building over centuries and centuries and centuries. And so I would call this social wealth and ask whether it is right that the benefits of social wealth flow so overwhelmingly and in such a concentrated way to so few. And that takes us to what I think is going to be the fundamental challenge we face over the next few decades, that we have a situation where wealth is social, and yet you are really only able to take advantage of it if you are within these small communities. Whether if you're in the community of Facebook, if you work for Facebook, you get access to the wealth that Facebook generates. If you live within New York, you get access to the wealth that city generates. If you live within the United States, you get access to the wealth that the United States generates. And if you're outside these communities, you don't get access to it. And so there's an insider-outsider dynamic that is going to continue to deepen and to drive divides between all of us. And the worrying thing is that as we start to think about ways to address these problems, and we talk more about redistribution, many of the solutions are going to exacerbate these tensions. And so one might think we have this social wealth. Technology is a great resource that ought to make all of us better off. Can't we just redistribute it? And almost certainly we will have to as work becomes less valuable to workers. But the more we redistribute, the more people ask, what does someone have to do to earn a share of government benefits? Who should get the benefits from these government payments? And there will be people who say, I don't want someone who's not like me to have the benefits. I don't want someone of a different race or religion or nationality to have a share in these benefits. And so it's possible that in trying to solve some of these problems in very sensible ways, we will create new ones or we will add to ones that are already becoming more serious. These issues are going to become worse over time, and I think that the key thing to remember is that they're not going to solve themselves. And so we need to be active now in discussing ideas and in discussing ways to improve our society. Now, what might society need as automation begins to displace work? Well, I think when we think about what work does for us, it plays a few key roles. It obviously gives us an income. That's the main reason we all go to the job each day, because we need to put food on the table. So one thing we have to have a substitute for is an income, the income that work provides. Another thing that we're going to need to have a replacement for is the purpose and identity that we get from our work, and also from the way that we allocate our time. And so we're going to need institutions that replace all these things. But before we adopt these institutions, we're going to need to come to a social consensus about what they ought to be. It's not going to be the case that technocrats meet together in Davos and say, you know what, I think we're going to need to adopt this policy and do this amount of redistribution, and then everyone will sign up to it and agree to it. In the past, what's needed to happen is a broad social debate will unfold as different movements vie with each other to come up with solutions for the problem. And for those solutions to then be implemented, the people behind the ideas need to persuade a majority to agree with them. They need to be able to find ways to wield political power to put those into place. And so in the 19th century, you had a broad social and ideological debate that led to different ideas about what should be done. You then had political movements that tried to put those ideas into place. And you had trade unionism. You had the development of labor parties. You had groups like the communists who proposed wholly new ways of organizing society and who fought to obtain the political power to put those ideas in place. And some of those ideas were okay, and some of those ideas were not okay. And I think the right way to see where we are now is at the beginning of a broad social argument, a broad social debate that will become a broad political debate, and which I hope eventually will lead us to a much better world, a much fairer distribution of the gains that we're able to take advantage of and able to create through these new technologies. But the road is not going to be an easy one. And the most important thing for us to be aware of is this history that we've gone through, this way that we've had to deal with technological change in the past, and to be aware of the lessons of this history, that if we're not active in trying to address those who are left behind and trying to meet their needs, there will be people who are willing to play on their worst impulses, and that could lead to quite a lot of destruction. So hopefully we can have a positive debate over the next decade or so about what to do and avoid those nasty outcomes. So thank you all very much. I think, Luis, should we now have a conversation? Thank you.
Thank you. Bueno, hola, buenas. Soy Luis Villa y trabajo de director de estrategia en Fior, que es una empresa de diseño que fue adquirida por Accenture hace unos 3 años más o menos. O sea, es muy interesante el tema de la cultura. O sea, nuestro trabajo es convertir la tecnología en experiencias que pueden usar las personas, ¿no? Poner a la persona en el centro, sea empleado, sea cliente, sea ciudadano, etcétera. Y un poco la idea es, pues un poco ese trabajo es lo que decimos, ¿no? El humanizar la tecnología, humanizar los negocios y también ser un poco críticos, ¿no? Muchas veces nuestro trabajo es más hacer preguntas que dar respuestas a un problema, ¿no? ¿Por qué quieres esto? ¿Por qué quieres lo otro? ¿No? Entonces, la idea hoy ahora es, bueno, con Ryan tener un pequeño debate. Hablaré en español y seré traducido, de manera que si cualquiera tiene algún problema con inglés o lo que sea, no tenga excusa, ¿eh? Entonces, podéis, cualquiera que tengáis alguna duda, pregunta o participar, pues podéis lanzarla y a través de Twitter, sobre todo, lo gestionamos, ¿de acuerdo? Bueno, pues básicamente, un poco para empezar. Y antes estaba hablando un poco, leía el otro día en un libro de Smisek, que es el Platform Capitalism, hablaba de que decía Arthur C. Clarke, el autor, que el futuro del trabajo será el pleno desempleo, ¿no? Que básicamente que no habrá, sí, es el... Entonces, un poco la idea, quitando la parte negativa o pesimista de ese no trabajo, todo lo que hablamos de las pagas, etcétera, del extravío, de pues, un poco la gente un poco perdida, la parte positiva de ese digamos, excedente de no trabajo, ¿cuál podría ser? O sea, estamos hablando de arte, creatividad, el trabajo como entretenimiento incluso. ¿Cómo ves esta parte positiva de este mundo sin trabajo?
Well, so I guess I've dwelt on the downsides a little bit, haven't I? It's kind of a gloomy picture. But the thing to remember is, yes, you're right. If we solve these problems and if we manage the transition in a satisfactory way, we all should be much, much better off. Uh-huh. And this was the case during the Industrial Revolution, that, yes, there were people living very difficult lives in the mines and the factories. But also, over time, we lived much longer lives, much healthier lives, with many more opportunities to enjoy free time and more consumer goods. So we should be able to do that. If the robots are going to take our jobs, that means we're not doing our jobs. And as long as we don't tear ourselves apart, that should be a good thing. Now, it does create the issue that the role played by work that helps us sort of figure out what to do with ourselves is no longer there. Mm-hmm. And I think we will have to address that in a few different ways. I think we will have to evolve new social norms. We'll have to, if we're not relying on the market to push people in one direction or another direction, we'll have to use other cues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we do this to some extent now, where I think people understand that they need to look after older people in their community and things of that nature. We understand that we have social responsibilities outside of work, but those are going to have to be developed in a much broader way to try to encourage people to use their time and energies in a useful way. I think, you know, possibly there will be a role for government in creating opportunities for people to explore different things and to develop new skills. But I think also there will be some sort of, you might call it entrepreneurialism or some innovation as people invent new ways to spend their time. And I think one interesting thing to watch over the next 10 to 20 years, and actually it's already happening now, is if you think about people who are retiring, they, you know, it used to be 50 years ago, you retired, you lived for a year, and that was basically it. Now you have 20, 30, 40 years of healthy life ahead of you, and you have a basic income to rely on. And so pensioners and retirees are asking themselves this question now. What do I want to do? I have time to get a new degree or to learn new skills. And as they do this, I think we're seeing the development of institutions, of people who have expertise and volunteer to hold workshops so that they can help other people learn the things that they understand. We're seeing growth in voluntary organizations where people can contribute to the community and things like that. But I think we will have to realize some people will not choose to do any of that. There will be people who choose to be on the couch all day playing video games or whatever.
Netflix.
And Netflix, is, yes. Virtual reality, who knows what sort of opportunities will be there. But my hope would be that we would accept that and we wouldn't try to force everyone to do something just to keep themselves busy, because that would be a horrible missed opportunity.
Vale. Otra cosa más. La revolución industrial, un poco, yo lo que veo es que mucha gente está intentando buscar patrones en el pasado para entender qué puede estar pasando, ¿no? O sea, cuando... Yo siempre digo que las crisis es cuando tienes más preguntas que respuestas, ¿no? Pues ahora hay demasiadas preguntas y parece que vienen muchas personas que vienen con la respuesta directa, que es la tecnología. La solución es la tecnología y muchas veces es el principio de otro problema, ¿no? Entonces, respecto a la revolución industrial, con todos los cambios que ha habido, la implantación de diferentes tecnologías y todo el tema social, empresarial, etcétera, ¿qué es lo que se repite más o menos que nos puede servir como aprendizaje y qué crees que es diferente que tenemos que tener en cuenta hoy, ¿no?
I think, you know, one of the most important things, as you say, that, you know, those who think that the technology will come up with solutions to the problems it creates and everything will work out are mistaken. That in the Industrial Revolution, new technologies created phenomenal new possibilities. And you think about the railroad and how it transformed life and distances that once you might have, you know, traveled one time in your life and you weren't sure you would survive it. You know, you could suddenly make in a period of days, and that was a fantastic thing. But railroads, as they gathered, as they consolidated power, were able to abuse the market system. They were able to accumulate phenomenal profits in an unjust way, and it took government to step in and regulate and in some case break up enterprises or nationalize the railways for those systems to work out okay. And that's going to be the case for a lot of industries now. Mm-hmm. I don't think all the parallels are going to be precisely perfect. But one of the big lessons should be that the problems don't solve themselves. I think one of the other things that's going to be key is the understanding that it took changes in outlook, in our view of society and of what the role of government ought to be in society for these systems to work. If you go back to the 19th century and you were to tell someone, did you know that in 100 years the top marginal income tax rate is going to be 90%? And they would say, what are you talking about, income tax? I've never heard of that and I think that's a terrible idea. So we went from having almost no tax at all to having a system where people were quite very heavily taxed indeed. And I think we should expect for social ideas that might seem unthinkable now, like taxing a lot of people to pay for incomes for people who never do paid work, to become acceptable over time.
Okay. Una cosa también es el tema del trabajo, la cultura en la empresa, y luego estamos hablando muchas veces también, la gente habla de los millennials, que es este grupo, ¿no? Que estoy hablando. Y básicamente hay un tema ahí con que estamos llegando a un momento donde se empiezan a incorporar hasta cuatro generaciones compartiendo el espacio de trabajo. Lógicamente, todos con diferentes expectativas. Estás viendo personas de 40, 50 años que están prácticamente asustadas con el cambio, que les puede pillar, quedarse sin pensión o lo que sea. Y la gente joven un poco pues intentando buscarse pues la vida, pues haciendo empresas, startups, etcétera. Entonces, básicamente, hay un poco como una especie como de choque de generaciones, ¿no? ¿Cómo podemos hacer que puedan convivir todos, que todos puedan generar algo que sume en vez de...?
Well, sometimes they literally live together. I mean, that's one of the interesting things we've seen. As there's not enough work for young people, they often end up staying with their parents for longer periods of time. It's an unprecedented situation. We've never had this kind of world where there were so many different cohorts with so many different sets of experiences working together. I think like so many things that have to do with the digital revolution, if we get the policies right, if we get the response right, it's a fantastic opportunity for knowledge to be shared across generations, for people who are young and who understand the technologies to explain those technologies to older people and help them reap the benefits of it. I'm not that old, and yet when I look at Snapchat, I'm completely mystified by it. It just makes no sense to me. And so I'm going to rely on young people to tell me how it works. And so that's good. We'll get education in both directions. I think the risk is that we don't have the right response in place. And then, as you say, older people will be concerned about their pensions. They may be concerned about the crazy new ideas that young people have. There may be a lot of conflict in that way. And sometimes you see this from politicians, that they think the way to solve our employment problem is by lowering the retirement age, kicking people out of work as soon as possible to open up new jobs. But that's not exactly how it works. Mm-hmm. The people who are 50 and 60 years old have different skills and different areas of expertise that are valuable in their own way and can't be replaced by a 20-something. Mm-hmm. So I think it will be an interesting cultural thing to observe, and I hope that we can get it.
More or less, más o menos lo estamos observando todos, ¿no? We are observing that, more or less, everyone. Una cosa que vemos con la transformación digital también es, hay gente que lo llama evolución y hay gente que lo llama absorción digital. Es decir, es el old power, el poder tradicional, o sea, la generación que está capitalista, financiera, etcétera, y luego el nuevo poder digital que llega, dices, no, lo que está haciendo el antiguo esquema de poder es absorber el nuevo, remaquillarse y volver a generar las mismas dinámicas, pero incluso con más potencia, ¿no? Porque es a escala global, con inteligencia, con datos y con un nivel de granularidad para conocer a las personas nunca visto, ¿no? Entonces, ¿existe este nuevo poder digital, este new power, teniendo en cuenta el antiguo, el actual?
Well, I think it, there are a lot of ways in which power operates differently than it did in the past. One of the interesting things that we've seen is the value of data, and there's a lot of talk about the importance of data and the role of data in the economy. But really, when you talk about machine intelligence, what you're talking about are clever programs that are useless unless they have massive amounts of data to churn through. That's how they teach themselves. That's how they learn to predict what we want them to predict. And so the data becomes incredibly powerful and incredibly valuable. And so control of the data matters. So if you're Google and you have this enormous data set, a new startup that wants to do something new in the economy, it has to come to you hat in hand and say, whatever your terms are, we want you to buy us so that we can have access to the data. So it shifts power in that way. Mm-hmm. If we were to change the property rights over data and say to people that you have ownership rights over your own data, then that would be a very different dynamic where there would be advantages to all of us pooling our data together and then bargaining with companies to have them pay us for it, which would be novel, wouldn't it? But then I think there are other very serious questions, such as if you have companies that know almost everything about you, doesn't that create serious problems? So if health insurers or health companies can predict who is going to get a disease and who's not going to get a disease, that might affect how they choose to treat people. Companies who have that information might say, you know what, we really like you, but our algorithm says you're probably going to die in a few years, so I'm sorry, we're not going to hire you. And that's incredibly unjust and not the way the world should work. So figuring out how to use the incredible amount of information that we can generate from this data is going to be really hard and pose some serious ethical questions. And it's going to be abused, and we have to prepare ourselves for that also.
Vale, muy bien, pues vamos a dar paso a preguntas del público y vamos haciendo. Un poco, si queréis hacer alguna pregunta podéis usar el hashtag TechSociety, ¿vale? Y una primera pregunta viene de Isabel Martínez, que pregunta de, ¿me puede responder qué sustituirá el trabajo en la consecución de recursos para vivir?
What will substitute for work?
Yes. What now?
What now? Well, I think one thing to recognize is that the technology that is displacing work in some places it can cause a lot of social and economic disruption long before we get to the point where 50% of people are off the job. So even if you think about something like driverless cars, that might only replace a few million workers, a few million truck drivers and cab drivers, but that will be enough to create immense social disruption. So we're going to have to confront some of these problems long before work vanishes. Mm-hmm. But eventually, more and more of us will find us affected by this and will not be able to earn a living through work. And so what institutions might there be to replace it? Well, I think that if we have something like a universal basic income, if we come up with a clever sort of scheme to redistribute income, that creates a lot of really nice possibilities. So you could have a category of work that is sort of semi-professional, that it's not volunteering, but it's also not doing work that you rely on for your income. And so it could be that, you know, you've always enjoyed baking, you open a bakery, you sell baked goods, and the money you earn from those baked goods covers your costs. You could never earn enough doing it to keep yourself alive, but you don't have to worry about that because you've got a basic income from the government. And so you're providing something of value, you're doing something you enjoy doing, and you don't have to worry about the fact that in doing this you're going to starve if you don't sell enough muffins. And there's potential to do this kind of work in all sorts of different settings. And I think that's one thing we'll see. But I also think that in some cases governments are going to respond by creating more make-work jobs. And mm-hmm. You already see this in places like China, where social stability is important and unemployment is just incredibly dangerous. State-owned companies are creating lots and lots of jobs for people that aren't necessary, but they can't afford to get rid of them because unemployed people would be a threat to the regime. And so there's a concern that that might be one solution that we offer. So there's good visions of the future and there's bad visions of the future. Which one we get largely depends on the choices we make.
Sí. ¿Hay preguntas del público presente? Sí, está viendo. Ah, por ahí, perdón. Emilio.
Yeah. I hear you. So it's the reenactment of the Industrial Revolution. And maybe I'm reading this wrong, but it took two world wars and one revolution and a Cold War to tame capitalism and make it more or less civilized. So are you expecting that type of... because it's a sanitized version of history. You're telling us to rationally debate. Well, that was not what happened. That is your fear, and how do we avoid it? And then it came up to me that maybe it's about enlarging work, actually. Why? Because now we are limited to what we can sell. But what if we don't need to sell it? What if we can do things, take, for example, what it needs to be done about climate change? There are things that possibly will not be economically feasible, and yet ecologically very sound. Maybe we will be freed to do work rather than instead of selling it to companies that, you know, profit from it.
Well, so both very good points. To take the first one, I mean, the cold, hard reality is that during the Industrial Revolution, inequality went up and up and up, and then it went down. And the reason it went down is because we had two world wars and we had a Great Depression. And that's sort of the way it happened. Now, does that mean it has to happen that way? I don't think so. I think it's certainly possible that we could learn from the past and respond preemptively. I think the hard question is in knowing what would it take to generate the urgency, the sense that we must take action now in order to prevent those catastrophes. And I don't know. I hope it's not that kind of conflict. But as we see the complacency with which people approached the candidacy of Donald Trump, with which they approach the Brexit referendum, it's clear that we are not, you know, we're not feeling the sense of urgency yet. And it may take more of a crisis to feel that sense of urgency. I really hope it doesn't mean we have to fight world wars, in part because we have weapons now that we didn't have then, and it could be a very short war. To take the second part of that, I mean, I think you make an excellent point. And I guess the thing I would really emphasize is that we have this sense that we must rely on market incentives to encourage people to do things. And market incentives are really important. They make a big difference. They are the reason that we get up in the morning, most of us, and go to work on days when we'd really rather not to. But we do other things for many other different reasons. There are all sorts of incentives that we face, all sorts of reasons we have for doing things. And so some people write software just because they want to. Some people work together to create new pieces of art or new pieces of technology simply because they enjoy doing it or because they want to make other people's lives better. And I think we can rely on those sorts of impulses to encourage people to do lots of productive things. And so I think just because we can't see beyond the dependence on the market economy doesn't mean there aren't great possibilities in this new world. And it could be, as you say, that we enlarge work to mean many more things that that are freeing.
Creo que había una pregunta por allí, ¿sí? Ahí, perdón.
Sí. Hola, buenas. La pregunta la voy a hacer en español. Usted ya ha apuntado anteriormente que la transformación digital tiene que ir acompañada de cambios en la protección social, porque si no se producen desequilibrios dentro de la sociedad. La realidad es que esos cambios tecnológicos van por delante de los cambios en los sistemas de protección social. ¿Cómo se van a corregir esos desequilibrios en el intermedio, en el interfaz, para poder mantener sociedades equilibradas?
Well, I'm not sure that we can. I think history suggests that we're always a few steps behind. And I think it goes back to part of this reason, part of the earlier answer, which is that we tend not to be able to coordinate together as in social movements or in political parties until we're really feeling the sense of crisis behind us. To get a great example of that, just think about the European Union and the Eurozone crisis over the last few years. Everyone has known every step of the way that there were serious underlying problems that needed to be addressed. Everyone sort of knew that the crisis would recur. And yet, until the markets were actually freaking out, you couldn't get the people in the room together to sort of strike some sort of bargain. And so I think it is clear that technology is going to run ahead of our ability or the ability of our institutions to solve the problems. And I'm not sure there's a whole lot we can do about that other than to do our best to try to anticipate these things and start the discussion now so that when the moment of crisis does come, we at least have some ideas in the toolkit to draw on.
So you kept referring on your talk about getting the response right. I would specifically want to know, what do you think two key institutions need to do to get the response right? Markets and government, especially from your perch in a publication like The Economist. What is the role of the state in this new phase?
Well, I should say not everyone at The Economist agrees with my views on all of these issues. Some of them are a little bit considered a little bit unorthodox. But I would say that for the market to respond in the way we would want it to, government may have to take some actions. I mean, the market is going to go off price signals. And the price signal that the market is getting right now is that labor is very, very cheap. And so the ironic thing that we see is that we have lots of people doing really low-wage, low-productivity jobs at a time when we should be enjoying this great technological abundance. And we have to think about ways to increase wages, in part because then firms would have an incentive to invest in new technologies in ways that would get growth up. So I think that's one of the problems that markets are facing. What about governments? Well, governments are inertial animals. They have a momentum of their own. They continue in the direction they're going until they're forced to go in another direction. And they are often quite large, and so it takes quite a strong force to knock them in another direction. And so I think, it's not necessarily reasonable to ask governments to solve the problem simply because they're built to solve a different set of problems that the problems that we were experiencing in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. And the institutions we have solve those problems okay, more or less. But we're going to need external forces to make changes within government, and that's going to take quite a while.
Vamos a hacer una pregunta de Twitter y la siguiente es por aquí, por favor. Luego, tengo también ahí, te tengo vista, no, a la una de Twitter y luego por ahí, ¿vale? Estamos, vale, la idea es un poco el a ver, es Andrés Pérez Perruca, pregunta, en su libro, página 287, dice que la educación no es la solución a estos problemas. ¿Puede desarrollarlo un poquito más?
Yeah, that's one of those heretical ideas. I think education is a useful thing, and it would be good if we could figure out ways to do better by the students who are being left behind. It would be better if we could figure out ways to make higher education more responsive to what economies need, and more affordable and more accessible to people who are outside of rich countries. It's not that education is not important. It's that I think the idea that all we have to do are take the people who are being displaced and give them some retraining and then they will be able to fill the new opportunities that are being created is not right. And it wasn't right in the 19th century. It wasn't the case that, you know, 40-year-old workers, craft workers who were weaving and who were replaced by machines then went and got a great education and were able to fill the new opportunities. It was their children or their children's children who had that opportunity. And so that's one way in which it's not going to work. But the other way is the fact that many of us are about as educated as we can be. I started a PhD and I quickly left it because I decided it wasn't for me and I don't think it would have been much use for society if I had kept going on that route. And I think that's true of a lot of us. We have developed our capacity to a great extent, to a much greater extent than past populations have. And it's not reasonable to expect us all to be contributing to quantum computing. And so I think that while education would be a wonderful thing and it's something we should continue to focus our energies on, that's not going to be the thing that solves the fundamental problem that's facing the great bulk of the mm-hmm. workforce.
Yeah. Hello. Yeah. As you referred previously...
Oh.
The new digital economy relies mainly on data. And on one side, we saw is in Europe, for instance, with the new General Data Protection Regulation, that the objective is to preserve the ownership of data to the people. And in a way, you've got the right to get the transportability of data or not. On the other side of the Atlantic, well... implicitly, you renounce to the ownership, and the owner of the data now are the GAFAs, in a way. So which model do you believe is going to be the winner? Because in the end, it's going to condition a lot the future and the different scheme of business models.
Well, I think the two models each have advantages and disadvantages. The advantage of the American model is that companies basically don't need to worry about what anyone else thinks of their use of data. They can plow ahead with their new projects. And so, I often wonder, you know, maybe you've had this experience where you're looking at your cell phone and, you know, a couple of days before you had been in a random shop looking at a random product, and then you're scrolling through something on cell phone and you see an ad for that product and you think, how did they know that I was in that shop looking at that very thing? And you start to suspect that maybe they're spying on you, or maybe this doesn't happen in Europe. This is just an American thing. So I think that, you know, the lack of sort of restrictions on data use in the United States is very valuable in the sense that it aids this process of innovation. But it comes with a cost, which is both that people lose privacy and also that they lose this important bargaining chip that they could use to get a share of the gains from growth. Now, the ideal thing would be to have a model that that combines the advantages of the two systems, that where you say, you have ownership rights over your data. We, the government, are going to create a public database to which companies, who are going to use the data in ways that we deem acceptable, have access. And then those companies can use that data to create products that benefit us all. But that requires a lot of foresight. It requires getting companies on side. And I'm not sure that either of those things is going to be happening in the future. And it may be that we're already too behind the curve. That the massive amounts of data companies have already collected gives them an edge that we can't really fix.
Allí.
Sí. Me siento muy dividida. He tomado una nota sobre ideas que necesitamos para afrontar el cambio y la transformación digital. Entonces, me pongo y digo, bueno, tenemos que imaginar la realidad, punto uno. Pero los datos que tenemos, que tenemos un montón de datos, no sabemos hacer las preguntas precisas a los datos. Y aquí viene un lío. O sea, por un lado, me tengo que imaginar algo con unos datos a los que no sé qué preguntas hacer. Y por otro lado, y mi pregunta es esta. ¿Cómo una empresa puede medir la necesidad de transformación digital? ¿En qué? ¿Y cómo en sus servicios, en sus procesos? ¿Y cómo puede dar ese cambio? Ya está.
Well, we don't always know what the right questions are to ask. And I think, you know, in many phases of writing this book, I look back at the Industrial Revolution. And you take something like steam power. Today we know all the sorts of different things you can do with steam, but back then they didn't. And so it took people experimenting and trying lots of different things. And the experiments they chose were ones they thought could make them money. People think that the Industrial Revolution got started in Britain because British workers were really expensive, and so people who owned factories there were like, it really would be nice to not have to pay these workers so much. Why don't we try using this new steam technology? And then over time, as it was used, we learned more and more about how to use it well, and we found new outlets for the industry. Other countries adopted it, and then it became very widespread. And I think that's sort of where we are right now with a lot of these things, with a lot of machine intelligence, is that we can imagine all sorts of possibilities. We're not sure which ones are going to work. We're not sure which ones are going to be useful. And so we need to do some experimenting. Now, one issue is that experimenting is largely left to for-profit companies, and that's going to affect the questions that get asked and the experiments that get run. It wouldn't have to be that way. I mean, we could fund much more public research to try to figure out what's doable, what's feasible. But also, they have the incentive to try to save themselves money. And right now, because wages for workers have been so low, they're not using it in lots of places where it might be socially beneficial because it's convenient for them to keep relying on cheap human labor. And so I think we could solve a lot of problems at a stroke by trying to increase worker bargaining power, which would increase incomes and also give more incentive to firms to try to find these uses. But still, I think it would be a good counterweight to the for-profit companies to have more public investigation into how we can use AI, how we can use AI badly, and avenues we shouldn't go down. Those are the kinds of things we need to be thinking about.
Por allí, hay un...
Soy Adolfo Castilla. Da la impresión de que la revolución, la nueva revolución que estamos poniendo en marcha, crea, de acuerdo con las primeras hipótesis, crea desigualdad y desempleo. Y eso es grave porque, entre otras cosas, el trabajo es el mecanismo de distribución de la riqueza más poderoso que tenemos. Y si ese mecanismo se viene abajo, no hay posibilidad de pensar en una sociedad en la que muchas personas estén subsidiadas porque no tienen empleo. Luego, habrá que buscar otros caminos, y yo lo que saco a relucir que hasta ahora ha habido poca referencia a por lo menos tres dimensiones. Una, el autoempleo. Es decir, el autoempleo va a ser una componente importante del futuro y lo está siendo ya. Dos, el crear nuevos intercambios. La humanidad ha avanzado con el intercambio de productos, con el intercambio de bienes y servicios. Luego tendremos que pensar en nuevas formas de intercambio. Es otra dimensión. Y la tercera, que saco a debate, es la colaboración con las máquinas. Es decir, no la competencia, sino la colaboración por las máquinas. Vía colaboración puede que surjan estas soluciones y estos autoempleos a los que me refiero. Gracias.
Well, you make some very good points. I guess I'll add a comment mostly on the last one, which is there is another avenue available to us, which I didn't really talk much about, which is the combination of man and machine. And it is possible that rather than relying more heavily on artificial intelligence, that we'll try to augment our own intelligence. And we could do that through using things like brain implants. We could do it by trying to engineer genomes and things of that nature. And it is certainly possible that we simply make ourselves better as humans technologically. There are several things about that I find not that plausible as a route forward. One is that the technology to displace work is happening much faster than our ability to re-engineer all of humanity to occupy these new roles. Another is that we have no experience trying to augment ourselves in these ways, and there are all sorts of potential health risks, ethical risks associated with them. We also have many other more serious medical problems that we might want to use the technology to address first. And then third is inequality, that if we go down this path, the people who are going to take most advantage of it will probably be those with the greatest resources. And so then you have even more of a spread in ability and in the ability to take advantage of the digital revolution. So I just wanted to mention that my vision is obviously not the only one out there, and that there is this other possibility. But I think it's even, if it's possible, more dystopian than the one that I've outlined.
Vale, pues, aquí, por favor.
Thank you. It's been very interesting. Do you think it is conceivable a circumstance of deflationary moment? So salaries going down, prices for goods and services going down. Deflation has always been very scary, but maybe this time is not that scary because we don't grow, but prices go down, salaries go down. What do you think about that?
It's a very interesting point, and I think, you know, if machines become better and better at doing things and producing things, we would expect prices to go down. And if you look at electronics and computing power, the price of those things has absolutely plummeted over the last few decades. I mean, there are a few tricky things about this process. One is that prices for other things keep going up, and one of the reasons that they keep going up is that we find it very difficult to make those sectors more productive. And while technology could be used to make them more productive, that could have consequences that we wouldn't like as a society. So to give you an example, housing is something that becomes more and more and more expensive, and that we haven't gotten better as a society at building more of more effectively. We can imagine how technology could be made to produce much, much more housing, but I'm not sure that it would do that in a way that we would find desirable. That, you know, would we want robots building, you know, massive amounts of identical housing on distant suburbs? Probably not. And, you know, something similar applies to healthcare, where there's value in automating some parts of healthcare. In other parts, we're, I think, for some time to come, going to want human touch. And that human touch means that prices need to continue going up. So that's one issue. The other issue is that prices and incomes may go down, but other things, the value of other things is not going to go down, like debt. And so there's a lot of debt around, much of it here in Europe. And if we were to suffer a period of deflation of incomes, that would make that debt much, much harder to pay. And that's not an insoluble problem, but solving it means that someone takes a loss somewhere along the lines, and that's a very difficult thing to impose.
Sí.
Hola, creo que me toca por aquí. Sí, quería saber aquí.
Por allí. Oh, sorry, I thought we were confused.
¿En qué lugar imagino o qué lugar colocaría las humanidades dentro de la solución al problema o a la construcción de la nueva sociedad? Estamos hablando de tecnología, de robots, de problemas éticos. ¿Qué puede aportar las humanidades, la filosofía, la cultura?
Gracias. I think the humanities are incredibly important now. I think an understanding of history is incredibly important now. I think that science fiction writers have often been some of our best guides for the problems that new technologies can create. and the trouble we might have in solving them. And then I think, of course, when we're talking about the ethical difficulties that new technologies might create, there's an important role for philosophy in thinking about what steps should we, what thresholds should we not cross. So in terms of addressing these very big issues, the humanities, I think, are important. I think they may also be important in a very sort of technical and practical way, in that when we get back to how do we want to use artificial intelligence, we want to use it in ways that make people's lives better, and that's going to mean dealing with them face-to-face, with understanding how they operate, why they are the way they are, and that's going to mean, you know, figuring out what makes humans tick. And figuring out what makes humans tick is quite often the role of the student of humanities. And so it could be that companies like Facebook, like Google, and in fact this is already true, they are hiring people from the arts, from the design world. They're hiring people who are experts in linguistics, in philosophy, because they need these people to help figure out how this stuff is all going to work. And so, you know, obviously we need the expertise in coding and in understanding how all those sorts of things work. But I certainly wouldn't advocate cutting back on support for the humanities, which are more valuable than ever.
Okay, so when we were teenagers, millennials, they told us that we could be doctors and engineers and farmers or whatever we wanted. And we found some of a meaning in that. And we followed that path. And now we are 20 years old, 23, 24, whatever, and most of my friends are unemployed. So the thing is, I have a little brother who is 14 years old. So what should I tell him? He can be what? Because I cannot even know what the world is going to be in 10 years. So what should I call him? What his call should be, or what things he could pursue, or I don't know. Yeah. What do you think about that?
It's a very, very good question. I guess I would say a few things. One is that the world is unpredictable, and to be able to teach yourself new things and to learn new skills is the most valuable attribute you can have, because you don't know what the world's going to throw at you. And so that's the most, you know, don't become hyper-focused on one small area, but learn to learn. So that's one answer. Another answer, I think, is to teach yourself or explore parts of yourself that you enjoy and that you love to do, because work may let you down. Society may let you down. And to know that you enjoy playing piano or painting provide some solace to you. It may also become a way of earning a living in this world where, you know, we don't need so many people to do the typing, but we do still want people to play concertos for us in the evenings. And then the third thing I would say is that you could always consider becoming a politician or politically active. And it seems we think of politicians as being such awful people, and sometimes they are. It's an incredibly important role. They're the people who are there trying to understand what we as humans want, what we're not getting, and what potentially we could achieve in the future. And as we look back at history and as we solve these problems, there were bad politicians who had bad ideas and who led us in bad directions. But there were also important reformers who signed important pieces of law into place that made the world better for all of us. And so, you know what? If the politicians are failing you, try to replace them. That might be the way we get out of this mess.
Bueno, nos estamos quedando sin tiempo y solo tenemos tiempo para una pregunta. Y
so I come from Britain, where not only is our government about to is trying to dismantle our relationship with the European Union, but also for the last 6-7 years has been reigning in the welfare state to a terrific degree, on the grounds that the welfare state has produced inertia, lack of productivity, lack of initiative, and corruption. Meanwhile, the Labour Party, the left, is completely in the doldrums and is simply strengthening the hand of people like Theresa May. I just wonder where you see, I don't know whether you, in your argument, you talk about this is a sort of extension of welfare, or universal income is an extension of welfare, but I just wonder whether you had any sense of where in the political spectrum some of these ideas might be taken up in a more practical way. I mean,
it's a very good question. I think Britain is in a somewhat unique situation in that its sort of Labour Party is so unhelpful at this moment that it's hard to imagine them as carrying the torch for new ideas and about how to expand the welfare state in useful ways. On the other hand, the Lib Dems were in the coalition and helped. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds of British politics, but they were there with David Cameron helping to cut some of these programs. So I don't know. It's possible that we need new parties. It's possible that we just need new ideas within the old parties. But I think there is a remarkable capacity for old politicians to reinvent themselves. And I sort of look to the United States, where not long ago, Democrats seemed the most conservative, small-c conservative, that is, unwilling to consider big, bold, ambitious ideas party around. And they were very scared about, you know, Republicans thinking that they were crazy liberals who had all these crazy ideas. And then they found out that going down that road and not being bold enough didn't pay. And so now a lot of people who for a long time tried to be, you know, very centrist, very middle of the road, cautious, are saying, well, you know, we need to listen to a Bernie Sanders. We need to listen to an Elizabeth Warren. And even if we don't agree with all their ideas, the fact that they were thinking in a bold way about what's needed, is important. And we can learn something from that. And we can learn something from the response to voters from that. So I don't have a clear idea of what politics is going to look like in the future. But I think I think the important thing is that the new ideas are aired, and it's less important where on the spectrum they come from. But and Britain, the that looks like a particularly dire case. So.
Almudena quiere decir algo para cerrar.
Mr. Aben, hace dos días celebramos el Día Internacional de la Felicidad con esta visión tan esperanzadora, pero tan real. ¿Qué podemos esperar para conseguir celebrar con mayor deseo, pero un deseo real, no solamente ilusorio, el futuro que nos espera a finales, para en las próximas décadas, dentro de 30 años, por ejemplo? ¿Qué rayito de esperanza podemos tener para saber que vamos a seguir siendo habitantes de un mundo habitable? Y humanamente concebido, humanamente social.
Well, I often focus on the problems, and it is important to recognize that even though technology is not going to provide all the solutions, it is going to provide some solutions. And so, as we think about improvements in medical technology, we can see progress that's being made in curing diseases that have plagued us for a long period of time, in treating chronic conditions, in amputees suddenly having incredibly good limbs that they can control with their mind, and people who couldn't walk before able to walk again. And so we will have advances along those lines, and that's something to look forward to. I think it's been incredible how cheap solar energy has become over the last 10 years. And that's an incredibly important thing as we try to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. And so we could look to the future of energy technology and say that, you know, maybe we have hope of surviving climate change, even if our politicians have been pretty unhelpful on that score. And then, you know, I think we shouldn't give up on the next 15 to 20 to 30 years. It's not set in stone that things are going to keep getting worse. And the more we recognize that there's a problem, and the more people become active and demand better responses from their leaders or try to replace those leaders, the better off we're going to be. So, you know, we have the past to guide us. And I have two small children of my own, and I can't bear thinking of them living in a terrible in the sorts of terrible futures I sometimes lay out in the book. And so I have to sort of in my heart be an optimist in that sense. And, you know, hopefully that will be the way things turn out.
Bueno, pues tiempo de crisis, tiempo de preguntas, ¿no? Hay muchísimas preguntas que se van a quedar sin atender de Twitter, de la sala. lo sentimos mucho, pero el tiempo es el que hay. Y bueno, para más respuestas, el libro de Ryan está en la mesa de la salida. Si tenéis interés, lo podéis adquirir ahí. Y bueno, que va a haber más eventos, más jornadas como esta en la Fundación. Lo podéis consultar en aspen.fundaciontelefónica.com, ¿vale? Y muchas gracias, Ryan. Y nada, gracias a todos por haber venido y esperemos que haya sido interesante.
Hasta aquí nuestro programa de hoy. Nos escuchamos en el próximo episodio y nos leemos en las redes sociales del Espacio y de la Fundación.
Encuentros, un podcast de Fundación Telefónica, producido por Cuanda.